You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Welcome to episode one of a brand new podcast. Now, I know what you're probably all thinking. What the world needed was another marketing or brand related podcast. And you could be right. Maybe wait till the end of it and then find out or not. But we're going to try and do things a little bit different. Now, I'm delighted to welcome Jamie Poston from Transamerica to be our first guinea pig. It's a real honor to have you join us, Jamie, on the first one.
The honor is all mine. Thank you, Gabe.
Give us a little bit of your background and tell us a bit about Transamerica.
Yeah. So let's start with the current day. Yeah. So Transamerica, we're a financial services organization. So we're part of a global network. So we're sort of one of those large companies that you've never really heard of, maybe. Lots of different financial services, whether it be investments, asset management, insurance, retirement programs, voluntary benefit programs for large organizations all over the US. And as I mentioned before, we're part of a global conglomerate called Aegon. It's Dutch. That's why it sounds so strange. And I basically am the head of brand and marketing. So within the corporate function, my responsibility is I oversee brand strategy, content strategy, digital experience, our websites, as well as things like sponsorship programs and thought leadership and social media. So you think about the brand expression, whenever you hear about Transamerica around the world, it's not related to a specific product. That's my group and ultimately my responsibility. So as you can tell, like Gabe, I'm not a native of these shores. So I came out here to the US back in 2000 with the dot-com boom. So originally my background is advertising, worked at IPG and Omnicom, but was lured to the US with promises of untold riches based on the dot-com boom. And as you can tell, that didn't pan out, but I fell in love with
it. Well, otherwise you wouldn't be doing this podcast with me, right?
Exactly, yes. So yeah, and then basically I've been in Denver for a number of years, but I bounced around. I was in New York, I've been in San Francisco, just following where I thought I needed to be at the right time. Ended up in Denver, which I have to say, I'm very happy about. It's a beautiful city in a wonderful area of the US.
Yeah, don't talk about it too much because I think we don't want more people moving here right now.
Yeah.
Now, we met about 8 years ago at a client pitch when you were agency side as well. So was agency side just too easy? You thought, okay, let me go do the client side thing and give myself a real challenge in financial services where, you know, it's not like everyone wakes up in the morning thinking about brand.
It was actually a number of different things. I actually, especially sort of with the technology that came out of obviously the dot-coms and sort of the migration of opportunities, one of the biggest drivers for me, though, is after being in the agency world for, I don't know, probably nearly 15 plus years, I got sick and tired of sitting down with clients and listening to them and putting together sort of great plans, like strategic roadmaps, like take 3 steps forward, take 2 steps right, and you'll be exactly where you need to be to achieve growth. And I hand this plan off. A month later, they take a step to the left and they go take a left turn. And I'll be like, no, what are you doing? Like, it's so simple. I laid it all out for you. This is exactly what you do. You've got the media, you've got the strategy. And I realized, you know what? I've got all of this sort of opportunity. I'm going to step into the client space because I think these guys, I could run rings around them. Since coming client side, one of the things I've realized is that actually they weren't stupid people. It's just the world that they exist within is so much more complex with so many more nuances and blockers and everything else. What's kept me here though is just sort of I'm just fascinated by it. I mean, just the way that marketing has evolved, you know, advertising, which is where I came from, is almost a small sliver of a much bigger picture. It's like one little piece of a jigsaw puzzle. And I'm a very analytical person. And I just love the idea of, oh, suddenly your sort of spectrum, your perspective starts growing and growing and growing. And I consider myself a very curious person. You know, I'm someone who believes in lifelong learning. And listen, being on the client side for a major brand, yeah, I'm definitely getting taught new lessons every day.
We were talking last time, you talked about this crazy thing called marketing or this crazy thing called brand. What did you sort of mean by that?
I think when you think about sort of brand, I want to be very specific. Like I'm talking about brand here versus sort of product marketing.
With a big B, right? Brand with a big B.
Big B. Yeah, exactly. Again, being curious, but it's this notion of when you think about brand marketing, it's actually a contract that you're continually having to sort of develop and sort of negotiate on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly sort of basis, because at the heart of it, I don't own the brand. I mean, I'm responsible for it, but it's the relationship I have with the customers and consumers and the way in which we talk and engage in the whole experience. So that continually sort of provides challenges, because if you think about it, not owning the brand, I mean, yes, I'm responsible for it within the organization, but the other owner is the customer, the end user. And I can't control their environment. I can't control the climate. I can't control their priorities. So I'm constantly having to listen and learn and adapt. And again, that's something that keeps me really interested. It can drive me crazy. Like, you can have the best laid plans and then suddenly the meteor hits and you're like, okay, we've got to pivot. We've got to move. And it's that sort of being really proactive and thinking about scenario planning and what could or should happen. And then if it doesn't, how do you then sort of accommodate those changes in that new world that you've got to do business in?
So take us a little bit behind the scenes, because brand isn't the sort of thing that necessarily comes up all of the time. But right. When it does, then you're in it and hopefully you're never out of it. So can you maybe talk a little bit about what that journey has been like for you when you first started Transamerica, what the focus was, when brand and even the idea of purpose started to come up, and how things have evolved since then?
It's interesting, actually. One of the things that I found really fascinating, and I've worked for a range of different organizations, like, so I've gone from Unilever to Sony Music, and you're kind of sort of like, why would you be at Transamerica? Like, what is it about Transamerica? As an organization, and I think financial services companies, especially here in the US, over the last 5 to 10 years have woken up from this notion of, we sell a product, typically a commodity, an insurance policy, a retirement program, voluntary benefit, a mutual fund, to actually what we're selling is an outcome. And that's really sort of leaning more into sort of the B2C mindset, right? When you think about those great sort of B2C, like B2C companies, that's what they've been doing for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And the financial services organization realized that, oh, that's really interesting. And that's forced them to focus on our what the consumer wants, to a why we exist and why we have the right to sort of engage with someone, a consumer, especially in the B2B space. That's been almost sort of a revolution. And again, it's probably happened in the last 5 to 10 years. And speaking honestly, when I came aboard at Transamerica, they were probably late to the party. And so one of the things that, given my background in sort of consumer-focused marketing and brand marketing specifically, it's been really exciting to get people to focus on the why first, believe in that, and then build out from there. And I don't just mean sort of like saying, okay, this is what we believe in, and therefore that's what it's going to be. You've still got to sort of negotiate, is our why true to us, but does it resonate and is it relevant to the end user?
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because there's been a lot talked about in the world of purpose over the last few years. A lot of people jumping on the purpose bandwagon, a lot written about its association with ESG and caring for the planet and caring for the world. Yeah. But a lot of skepticism also, because in reality, most businesses are there, sure, to deliver profit. And I think there's a broader acceptance around a broader role. But this notion of leaning too far into purpose, unless it's truly at the heart of your business model, like a Patagonia, for example, whose business model is founded on purpose, how do you get credibility, or how do you contextualize the notion of purpose at a financial services organization like Transamerica in a way that, it, to your point, is authentic and truth and doesn't get too far into the fluff?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was just speaking just recently at our national sales conference, you know, in front of a couple of thousand salespeople. And I was, because we've repositioned our branding, and obviously brand is made up of purpose and promise. But if I was talking about our purpose, and I was sort of, two things I brought up was, first of all, the purpose is really, first and foremost, a platform of belief that binds us together as an organization. It's really sort of an internal. Like, do we all believe this? Can we all get on board? And if so, come join our team. And if not, get off the bus. You can go somewhere else. No offense. But that's really something that I think more and more people are looking for, somewhere that, okay, I can believe in that purpose. I can believe in what you're doing, whether it be ethical, whether it be credible, whether it be realistic, whether whatever it may be. You've got to be able to articulate that clearly. And you've got to be able to articulate it to every person within your organization. And it should be invigorating. It should be inspiring. Ideally, it should be aspirational, a little bit, to push people to sort of step outside of themselves. But I think that's number one. Going through that process, you can then sort of communicate that It may not be literally in the same, sort of using exactly the same language, but in meaning to an external audience, like that should be able to resonate with them. And I think for most people, where brands get caught up is when they try to employ a purpose that's built on what do we think the external audience wants versus what do we want to be? And I think that's it has to start on the inside. And then obviously from the brand purpose, that's when you develop the brand promise that means something. So one of the things I talked about was the fact that the language behind our purpose, our company's 115 years old. Back in 1906, a gentleman by the name of A.P. Giannini started our company back in San Francisco. And his ethos was he had this phrase, serving the needs of others is the ultimate calling of business. And what I was trying to sort of explain to our salespeople is our new purpose is helping people live their best lives. We've changed the language. All we're turning around and saying is we still have the same ethos. We've always had the same ethos. That's who we are. That's all we've always been. We just changed some of the language. It still has the same meaning to all the people who work at Transamerica.
Let's go back a bit to contextualize how you got to live your best life, because to someone from the outside listening in for the first time, it can almost sound like an empty promise, but there's so much richness and insight behind how you got there. I know that this is sort of the current iteration. Maybe go back a moment and talk about the purpose journey since you've been there and talk about it through a consumer lens that we can all relate to and understand, because they're things that are impacting our lives as they relate to retirement, the stages of life and all those pieces.
Well, there's a couple of things. As I mentioned, I've been at Transamerica now for 35 years, but even predating me, sort of around 2014, 2015, there was a recognition that, listen, it's talked about maybe in the trades more than it is in sort of the consumer press, but the US is facing a retirement crisis, meaning that the average cost of retirement for US people is somewhere over like $1.5 million, but the average US population in terms of a household has around $250,000 in retirement savings. Huge disparity. So something had to change in a way for financial services organizations to better serve their clients and customers. The old messaging wasn't working. And it was this realization that we talked about the commodity, we talked about the product too much. And this is what I was saying a little bit earlier on about you need to switch to an outcome. And so one of the things they did back around 2016, 2017, we started to talk about, okay, well, how do we talk about the outcome? And we started to uncover one of the biggest drivers of financial security or insecurity later in life is your health. Your wealth security, your financial security was directly tied to your health security, but people weren't putting the two things together. And so we worked with a number of academic partners, Stanford Center for Longevity, MIT's Age Lab, to really try and contextualize this, to focus on this idea of financial security, not as being this, how much money do you have in your 401k, but talk about your quality of life. And the reality we came to is this notion of, it's the paradox of longevity. So people are living longer. We all know that. And it's this notion that while it's never been easier to live a longer, better life, the cost of doing so is increasing exponentially. And the biggest driver is healthcare cost in the US. It's a big differentiator from Western Europe, where you've got a lot of socialized medicine. That was a big thing. And so we really started to lean in on that. And we developed a program called Wealth and Health, which is trying to sort of draw a correlation between you've got to really take care of yourself and think about saving for potential health impacts in order to be able to sort of just save for your retirement home, save for that second home, save for that college kids, you know, college education. What was interesting is we were like, no one's talking about this connection. This is exciting. No one's doing it. This is a unique space for a brand marketer. You love that white space, right? No one's in this area. And we launched this in 2018, put a lot of money behind it. And it kind of went, beep, boop. And so we did a lot of research with the financial services community, the advisors, agents, brokers, employers, and we're like, what's going on? Like, we've shown you the data. And literally what we heard back was, I've got this in voice of the customer research we've done. Why are you talking to me about health? You're an insurance company. You're a retirement company. You're not a health insurance company. You're not a medical provider. No, no, no. You don't get to talk to us about this. And so we went back to the drawing board and we started to figure out, well, hang on a second. If this is so important, if there's this direct link, why can't we own that space? And so what we found was it actually was we had to go one step further. It wasn't just us saying your health and your wealth are connected. We had to go one step further and talk about it's your healthcare cost. That's why we, as a guardian of your finances, are entitled to talk to you about your health. And once we did that, then it was clear. People got it. And that was stuff that we did heading into sort of 2020, and then obviously COVID hit. But one of the things we found out was that messaging worked really well with some of our business, talking about the outcome and identifying why we had ownership to talk about how we can improve people's lives, not just their bank savings, not just their retirement, but their quality of life. But there are segments of our business that just it wasn't resonating with. Insurance is all about protection, and healthcare cost doesn't go into that because, again, we're not a health insurer. So that's really where we've then been leaning in to say, okay, talking about outcomes really resonates, helps financial advisors, employers, everyone else say, okay, help me help people sort of live their best life. And we were literally like, that's what we need to do. If we can talk about how we can impact people's quality of life, not just about healthcare costs, but quality of life, then it gives us a brand that connects all of our different products to individuals. And then it helps us position as a differentiated provider. Given our breadth of products, we can literally provide a product for someone from birth to death. There are very few financial services companies that have that depth and breadth of services. So truly for an organization to be able to step forward and say, we want to help people live their best lives, we're able to actually do that. And that for us is that progression is we started focusing on outcomes versus product. We realized that that message resonated, but against a smaller segment of our population. So bridging to this new brand position allows us to talk to more of the population, allows us to bring more of our products and solutions to the marketplace.
It's interesting seeing how things have evolved. I want to go back just a little bit to that, because everything started from that spark. How did you get to that insight of the health and wealth?
It was a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Dr. Joe Goughlin, who's the executive director of MIT AgeLab. He was at a conference sitting down with, I think it was our president of our sales division at the time. And we were sponsoring Dr. Joe at this event. He was talking about this notion of age of longevity. And he was really pushing how is people living longer impacting every segment of American society. And that's what AgeLab is really focused on. And he was the one who came up with this notion of the paradox of longevity. That the reality is if the old model used to be a three-stage life. You're born, you learn 20 years. You go to work, 40 years. You retire for 15 years. And you use your savings from those 40 years to afford a life of relaxation for 15 years. He was having this conversation with this with our president of sales at the time. He was like, but people are living to 20, 30. In 30 years, people will be living to 1995. There is no way that you can save enough working 40 years to afford a 30-year retirement. So either people are going to have to work longer, or we're going to have to think about blowing up this whole three-stage life, which has huge impact on how a financial services company can provide services. Because again, the old model is blown up. And that was when we started to talk about, wow, if the whole paradigm has changed, then the way in which financial services companies talk and engage and the products and solutions they bring to market has to change as well. We've got to stop talking to people when they hit 55. We've got to start talking to them in their 20, 25, 30, and really put in place a plan that helps them sort of achieve a later life that works for them.
Were you actively looking for that spark and white space at the time, or was it just the sort of thing that you were always listening out for it and it just so happened that it just smacked you in the face because you were at a conference and had a conversation?
I think it was a little bit of both. There was this very clear understanding that we had to change the way in which we were doing business. And from a marketing perspective, we were looking for a change of narrative. If you're a taller student of financial services, everyone uses two or three colors, blues, greens, mauve, burgundies, that kind of thing. And they all talk about the same thing, which is, have you saved enough? Life is really expensive. And they use fear to drive reaction.
Total sea of sameness.
Yeah. And so the sea of sameness, everyone looks the same and they say the same thing.
And the products are the same.
Because you live in a very highly regulated business. We're forced to have very similar products because we all have to fit into the same box to get approved. So that's where brand can actually really lean in and be a differentiator. And that was the realization that, hang on a second, how we think, how we act, how we communicate as a brand is actually a potential growth driver for us. And that's, so we had this sort of, oh, we've got to think things through. So we're going back to the drawing board, thinking about what new insights, where is there some white space that we could move into with, realistically, with authenticity, without going off the rails and, you know, trying to be the Spotify of financial services. And then again, this individual, Dr. Joe, was talking to our head of sales, and he could communicate to the head of sales this makes sense. That was like, I've got head of sales coming to me and saying, we've got to focus on the outcome. Stop talking about our products. And it's all about, this is where we want to take people. And that's the journey we've been on since.
So as the whole health and wealth story evolved into the overarching idea of live your best life, you talked about purpose and positioning. What's the difference between the two and how do you use them?
For our guys, the way we think about it is brand purpose, again, is that sort of why we exist. It's that sort of, it's in our DNA. It's got to be true. It's got to be authentic. It's what binds us together. We have certain behaviors that allow us to live that internally. We talk about internally how we as an organization, we tune in, we step up, we want to be a force for good. Those are conversations that we are continually having internally within the walls of Transamerica, allowing us all to align around this. We exist to help people live their best lives. The brand promise is the external manifestation, the external communication out to other audiences, our external consumers and customers. And again, what makes it valuable, what the hard work that gets put into that is, it's not just how do we translate our brand purpose into an external message. It's we go out and we've been talking to agents and advisors and brokers. We've done in-depth persona work to understand what their world is. And then we connect their mission with our mission. And the promise is the bridge. It allows them to have their own identity as an agent or advisor or whatever organization, as an employer, but seeing us, a partner, a mirror image of, yes, we align. You get me. And that's where a brand should live. You understand my problems. You understand, we share the same mission. And then obviously brand experiences, you get me on a day-to-day basis with those sort of things. But that's a differentiation.
Can you talk a bit about how just consumer attitudes and behaviors have shifted more generally around, even if we did have enough money, that's not how we're viewing life, right? Especially for any Gen Zs or millennials listening.
Yeah, you know, actually, we've just completed sort of a somewhat first of its kind review with actually with MIT AgeLab. We sampled over 2,000 US individuals across each one of the sort of the core cohorts of demography. So 20-year-olds up to sort of 80-year-olds. And we're asking them sort of the impact of longevity on them, like impact of them in terms of their work, how they think about work, how they think about their wealth, saving, investing, what wealth actually means, and also their well-being. Like how do people deal with well-being when they're 20 versus they're 60 and 70? What's important? And what's really interesting is if you look at the earlier cohorts, so you're looking at Gen Z, for instance, early millennials, having work that's meaning and flexible came in. So meaning, like I'm doing something that actually gives me meaning, gives me a purpose. And that alignment between their work life and their personal life, that intersection is blending. And again, what we're seeing with that audience specifically is they want to have, it's not necessarily they want to work from home completely or they want to work in the office completely. They actually want flexibility to move around. And what we're seeing then in later stages of the cohorts, we're also seeing that people want to be able to take time off of work. They want to be able to spend time at home with their young children. So this whole idea that we have this sort of, we have these sort of cohorts of audiences that fall neatly into these sort of plan of action. We can plan exactly what they can be or what they want. That's being blown up. There's this idea of almost being sort of this sort of like quantum planning. What we do is we present solutions for life stages, but it's not dedicated to an age. It's not dedicated to a financial segment. It's just, we are prepared. When you are ready to engage, here's a solution, which is, it creates a whole level of complexity to brand marketing. It requires a whole different range of investment because we've got to create these programs ready to go, but we're responding to an audience when they need it versus us telling you, hey, you're at this life stage, you should be doing this. Here's a message that sort of drives you. So everyone always talks about consumer centricity or people-to-people marketing. We're seeing that really come into play.
How was the case made and what's the rationale for then why this work and why now it was the time to rebrand, like you said, an institution that's been around for so long, and also knowing that it's not the sort of thing that you have executives who take this sort of investment lightly?
I could sit here and give you, quite honestly, Gabe, a bullshit answer. I could be like, it was just, I woke up one day, or our CEO woke up one day and had a flash of inspiration.
Well, there's no one listening to this anyway, so it probably
is just so between us. I'm going to give you the honest answer, which is we had a change in leadership at the global level, a change in leadership at the national level. And they came in and they said, look, we've got to change the way in which we want to work. I think there was an opportunity for us to sort of reinvigorate the organization, try and sort of create a little bit of positive momentum, juice up the share price and everything else, stock price. And I don't mean to say like, it was purely that. I mean, I think there's good rationale, but essentially it was leadership at the top saying, we've got to reinvest in our brand. The brand is incredibly important. It's been undervalued, especially during COVID. And it was really trying to understand sort of leveraging the power of our global organization, our global supply chain, and being able to sort of say, okay, is there a way for us to create a global brand that speaks to all audiences in all markets, granted with some regional sort of customization and translation, that we can really push forward? And so that's the work that we basically embarked on. It was a, we think we can do this.
It's interesting. And I think it's very common across a lot of organizations who eventually do rebrand, where there is this correlation with new leadership coming in, because they just have a different definition and view of what brand can do, that they see that that brand can actually be a catalyst for that transformation agenda.
Listen, I'm a firm believer in the brand follows the business, meaning that the leaders of the business will sit there and say, we have a challenge or we have an opportunity. And oftentimes they're going to look at it through operational, they're going to look at it through sales. I'm fortunate enough to have leadership who turn around and recognizes this is an opportunity for brand to actually really contribute. And that's sort of, that's really what's happened over the last sort of 2 years, is like, okay, brand needs to be leaning in. Brand is an opportunity here for us to be able to drive business growth. So
take us into the craziness of where you are right now in this rebrand process.
So literally it's been 2 years of working with our corporate center out of the Netherlands, and then working with CMOs across 7 different markets. We were in 17 different global markets, but there's 7 other core businesses, and then working with them to try and sort of align around sort of the research that helps us understand where are our different audiences in terms of mindsets in regards to financial security. That research took about a year to coalesce. We've then actually engaged in sort of, okay, taking that research, taking that brand positioning, and making it fit within the US market, which has been a challenge, because there's this idea that there's this commonality, this common held belief that life should be a positive experience. And there is a certain cohort of audiences across the globe in all of our markets who wants to lean in, who wants to sort of be encouraged to sort of take control of their own lives. But in the US versus sort of the Netherlands versus Spain versus UK, there's a very different understanding of what quality of life means. And so what we've had to do is take this sort of global brand position and say, okay, in the US, this is really what quality of life is all about. So that's really where we are right now. And now we're basically, we just launched it internally and we're getting ready to launch it externally, which is a whole world of work that needs to be done.
So can you sort of dimensionalize that for us? I think you talked about it being, it's both interesting and scary. Like, how much needs to be done?
We have 220 regional sort of offices for our TFA, or Transamerica Financial Agency, or Transamerica Financial Advisors. We have 5 core locations in the US. We have 7,500 full-time workers. We have close to 10,000 other workers around. I've got to align our timeline in terms of the work that we're doing, visual identity updates, verbal identity updates with what Global's doing in terms of what's happening in the UK. So there's a tremendous amount of coordination. We're given a certain amount of freedom to sort of what we call freedom within the framework. But I've always got to be sort of talking to my bosses in the Netherlands to be like, okay, this is what I want to do. Why are you doing that? Well, can you hold on that? Because we're not ready. And so there's a lot of that work. And then internally at Transamerica, I mean, we've got people who've been with the company for 30 plus years. We've got people who have just joined in the last 3 months. I've got to try and sell them to get them to believe in this purpose and this new brand position. I've got to get them to be the advocates for them for this position. And I've got to listen to them in terms of what they want. And again, this message, one size does not fit all. So you have to be adaptive. I have to sort of have multiple different conversations. You know, one of the things I've learned is you can't just say something once. You've got to keep on hitting it. You've got to keep on like going. And you've always got to think about selling in these things based on the priorities of the person you're speaking to, and especially at the C-suite. I do a general presentation to our management board, and then I have a separate presentation for operations, a separate presentation for finance, a separate presentation for HR. I've got to talk to them about the brand as it relates to them. Because again, our CEO will tell you that brand's really important, but then you've got all the other day-to-day stuff that's happening. So I've really got to try and engage with them on a regular basis.
Any lessons that you've learned through this process so far?
Follow-up is one of them. With the best of intentions, I've got my priorities, I've got my timeline. I get a commitment from someone like, yep, we're going to do that. Yep, I'll get a team on that. And a month goes by, oh, yeah, sorry, I had to do something else. And suddenly you've built a plan, a coordinated plan, and they're not delivering. You're like, and there's humility as well. One of the things about being a marketeer, and especially in the brand marketing space, is everyone thinks they're a marketeer. So sometimes you're like, oh, you don't know. Like, I'm telling you what this is. I'm the expert. But actually, the humility teaches you, actually, you're right. Actually, what you've just said, even though you're not a marketer, that actually makes a lot of sense. I need to get off my high horse and actually, I'm going to take what you said and I'm going to incorporate it into our thinking because that's really important.
What do you say to the person, though, who has an opinion, you're like, no, they're wrong, but they think they're right? That's the hard one.
I hear what you're saying. I'm going to take that into consideration. Let me get back to you. And then I don't follow up. Brand is both the benefit and the challenge, right? Everyone finds a conversation with brand interesting because you get to talk about touchy-feely things and pictures and words and language. And everyone's like, oh, I'm into that. But one of the things I've always found is get close to your CFO, because at the end of the day, the decision will be made with a balance sheet in front of the management team. And that for me is one of the big challenges. It's because at the end of the day, in many ways, again, product marketing is different because you can turn around and say, I did this product marketing. I got this many leads turned into this many sales. Here's a cost per.
Right. You can connect it to the income statement, right? The P&L is much harder when you're talking about something that's more that connects to the balance sheet. That's about longer term that you typically measure in abstract terms like brand equity. Where does that show up in my financials?
Yeah, it's that you've got the tangible asset balance sheet, but no one's ever thought of the intangible asset balance sheet. And that's the correlation that I'm always trying to draw. Hey, listen, this is working. B2B is working. Your lead generation is working because we've increased awareness. And the CFO will be like, well, how much of that increase is down to your leads versus how much of that is down to we've got a great more bonus incentive for our sales teams? And that's the conversation. So you've got to build that trust with the CFO because they need to be the advocate in the room when the CEO is making decisions about when times are good, when the sun is shining, I can walk into a room and sell a brand program and everyone's like, yeah, that sounds good. Because everyone's got a smile on their face. It's when the clouds are darkening, it's getting colder and everyone's sitting there being like, all right, look at the balance sheet. I've got to have an advocate in that room who's willing to sort of say, no, the brand's important. Because as you know, brand is a long-term investment. It's an investment you're making into a customer relationship. You can't pull it off and pull it down. Not like you can do with product. I can pull one product down, replace it with something else. The brand has to be a long-term investment. And for many organizations, it's really scary to commit that capital on a 3, 5, 7 year plan.
So is that what you say to, like, how do you have that conversation with the CFO about brand in a way that works and build trust? Because I think a lot of peers, a lot of brand people don't really know how to have that conversation with a CFO in a way where he comes out of it, he's not just staring at you blankly.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't always have success. The most current iteration and the most current relationship that I've been able to sort of foster, it's about sort of re-spending the time and bringing them into the cycle of, okay, listen, B2B awareness, in terms of our target audience awareness, showing them the numbers and saying, look, we're at X point of awareness. And if awareness gets impacted, look at our consideration levels. Those are quantifiable terms. But then you have to sort of educate them on the other intangibles. So it's things like retention rates. Is retention rates going down? What does a cost of acquisition look like? If you're looking at sort of the volume and velocity of sales and trying to sort of correlate that back to, as our awareness goes down, it's getting more difficult here. We're not getting as many callbacks. We're not seeing as many RFPs. We're seeing client turnover. This could be part of the explanation as to why. Oftentimes, though, it's if you've got a CFO who's just very much focused on just the numbers and you can't get them to open up, that's when you've got a real challenge. That's when you have to go and look to advocates outside of the CFO. So operations, sales leaders, HR, and try and build sort of a consensus of the willing to try and sort of amplify your voice at the table with the management team.
Talk about one of the biggest mistakes that you've made and what you learned from it so others can avoid it.
Actually, it goes back to some of my early days. I used to work for Initiative Media. And I was a brand new sort of media strategist buyer on their floor. I was working with Elia Fabergé, was my client. And I was on a call and this salesperson was just like, listen, you've got to do this. This is, you know, last minute deal. You've got to commit to this. I need this contract. It's an annual placement. This knocks 30% off your rates. Can you do it? And me being green, I was like, 30% savings? I mean, absolutely. Like, let's do it. He's got buy order. I'm like, buy order, done. Hit the buy order on 3. And I walk into my group head's office and I'm like, hey, I just got us like a 30% discount on that. And she was this woman called Jane Wolfson. She was awesome. She was like, "You're a freaking idiot. Like, we can't commit to that. We don't have the..." I won't go into the details of contractual terms and everything else, but what I learned from that very early sort of experience was, when you feel pressure from somebody else to take an action, take a step back. Because if it's truly something that you can do, you can always come back. You can always, that is that last minute deal, that pressure, "I want it now." If you're feeling like something like, "Hang on a second, pause, take a second, get out of there." Okay? You never make a good decision, I don't think, when someone's yelling at you and being like, so that was a, I try and not to get myself into those situations, because typically I'll make the wrong decision. So I always have a little warning alarm that says, "Hang on, take a pause."
It's a great one. In your role, I mean, you're the most senior marketer at Transamerica. Where do you go for learnings and counsel with peers, or if you just need a vent?
There's certain, obviously, chat boards and stuff like that that you can go to. I mean, they're useful. Someone once said to me, actually, being a CMO or sort of chief marketer in an organization, sometimes the loneliest position, because it's one of those things, it's like, oh, there's no one else within the organization who has my awareness. Or typically, I've got a good network of peers that I can lean in on if I've got a question. Oftentimes, it's all about going to actually, sometimes someone who's actually not in the industry, but actually explaining something to them and actually running through my rationale and what do you think. I think mentors can be really helpful. And that's always something I think you need that outlet to sort of just double check your thinking. Agency partners, again, you can go back to them and be like, "Hey, this is what I'm thinking, or I'm not sure what to do."
On that last point, you've worked on both sides. What advice do you have for others, or how do you get the best out of your agency partners?
It's the last word. Is there a partner that you have to have there? The way I've always talked about it is, they're an extension of our team. You've got to bring them in. You've got to have that trust, especially working on the agency side. When I felt treated as a vendor, when I was treated as a tool versus actually a contributor, that's always created some dissonance and distance in thinking, in sort of passion. I always talk about when I'm hiring, for some positions, actually, when you hire from an agency, I will look for an agency person because I know agency people, because typically we're always underpaid. We always worked the long hours and you weren't in control. It was that passion. You do it because you're passionate about it. And I think as a partner, I look for that in people. And so I'm always looking for that. Like, if the agency partner is truly passionate about my business and doing best work, then absolutely you've got to trust them. And that's how I get the best out of them.
Go deeper. What are some of the actual things that you do to make them feel more like they're a partner? Can you give some examples?
Well, a couple of things. Take the time on the upfront to do the onboarding properly. You don't know what's sort of in your head. There's a notion of this curse of knowledge. I already know that, so I'm not going to sort of share it, because everyone must know that. The reality is, don't expect that. Don't anticipate it. Go deep and spend the time. You'll get the payback on the back end. I think the other thing is, this is another rule of mine, is if you're in a room, ask the stupid questions. And I always think about, with an agency, like, I will ask the stupid question because, listen, I've hired you because you're an expert. I don't have that expertise in-house. If I could do it myself, I would do it myself. So I have that sort of humility to be like, I don't know, tell me something. Am I wrong? Challenge me. That's a true partnership. It's like, you're not just doing this because I don't have the time. I've entered into this relationship with you because you bring something to the table. Having that sort of openness and, again, this notion of partnership, I think, is the best way to get the best out of everyone.
I say, Jamie, sometimes it's hard to know what it is that we do well. And having been lucky enough to work with you, what I can tell you is that I've always felt, we've always felt, almost as if you treat us the same way as if you were in the agency world. Your responsiveness and how you treat us, it's almost as if we're the client. And that is something that I rarely see. You think about clients that you work with, that you really give that extra. I think that's a real quality, I think, that you bring.
It always surprises me when you hear about sort of the average life cycle of an agency client relationship, and how agencies, especially working with strategic partners, you might cycle through every sort of 2 years. And I'm like, you've invested all this time and effort. Unless something's changed on the client side or the agency side, why would you disinvest? Why would you be like, all right, now I'm going to go somewhere else? So yeah, I always think about it as being, we're part of the same team.
Any advice that you would give to your 30-year-old self? I mean, it's not that relevant because obviously that was only 5 years ago, but...
I mean, specific to me, it was this, and I don't know if it's not necessarily regret, but I think I chased the money when I was younger. It's not necessarily regrets. I'm a little bit sad that I had this wonderful life in the US and suddenly the .com thing happened. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to go to the US and I'm going to be a millionaire. It's going to be fantastic. But I think the biggest lesson is I have this thing with my son. He's 13. I just caught onto this like in my early 40s. You've got to have the intent. Be clear in your intent and then apply the effort. Success will come. And I think one of the things I didn't have in my earlier career was I was kind of bouncing around between media and strategy and, oh, this sounds interesting and that sounds interesting. And maybe that was a good thing. But I feel like if I'd have been a little bit more like, this is where I want to be at 40 or 50 or whatever. But maybe that wisdom comes with age. Maybe that's not something I should have told my 30-year-old self, because I've had a hell of a ride. It's been fun.
What's a good book that you've read recently?
Orbiting the Hairball. I've just started it, but it's basically a guy who was a CMO at a large organization. It's just talking about how to sort of, within a large corporate organization, how to stay close enough to the corporate business function, but still retain enough sort of distance that you're still bringing value, that sort of that marketing creative spirit. Someone turned it on to me and I was just like, oh, really? Orbiting the Hairball? That's weird. So I've just started that.
As this is the first episode, I thought that it would be great to end with a final question that no one's ever asked before, because even if everything in this podcast is similar to everything else, I bet no one's ever asked this question. So I'll end with a slightly ridiculous one, which is, if I came in and I was your fairy brand mother, right? And it's my podcast, so I get to make up any sort of magical character that I want. What would be your brand wish?
Is it my wish for the brand or is my wish for my brand team?
You can answer it however you want. I like the team question. I like the team angle of that. It's good.
I'm going to say for my team, I'd want them to feel recognized and rewarded. Like as we're moving into this space, as the brand focus comes back onto the brand, I think that's something that I'm continuing to push them to be like, listen, yes, we're getting this opportunity. And right now they're like, their heads are looking down. They're trying to get stuff done. They're not looking forward. And what would really help them to lift their heads up is a little bit more like, we get you guys, get in there. I'm not sure if that's the right answer, but you asked me the question. That's my immediate response.
Hey, I'm your fairy brand mother. It's your wish. You can have whatever you want. Well, Jamie Poston, Head of Enterprise Marketing and Brand at Transamerica. Thank you for being on the first episode of our podcast. If anyone has any questions for me or Jamie, please drop me an email, gcohen@monogle.com. We'll see if I ever get to episode 2.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.